What is an unconformity?
It's a gap in the geological record. It's the point at which two layers of rock from different and non-sequential time periods meet. So these two layers will meet, but there could be a huge gap in time between them. So you can think of it, you know, sort of metaphorically as a hole in time. And, you know, it begs the question of what is in there in that gap? You know, what is it that's missing that can't be filled in? So I started to think of it in this way, as a, you know, like a metaphor for geology, for all of geology, archaeology, history and memory.
That's Hugh Raffles. We spend the hour talking with him about his new book, The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. Then, at the very end of today's show, a short story about the Cure Hunter. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. When Hugh Raffles' two sisters died suddenly within a few weeks of each other, he reached for rocks, stones, and other seemingly solid objects as anchors in a world unmoored, as ways to make sense of these events through stories far larger than his own. The book that emerged is The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. It's a profound and affirming meditation, grounded in stories of stones, Neolithic stone circles, Icelandic lava, petrified whale blubber in Svalbard, the marble prized by Manhattan's Lenape Indians, and a huge Greenlandic meteorite that arrived with six Inuit adventurers in New York City in 1897. Hugh Raffles is the author of the acclaimed book Insectopedia and of In Amazonia, A Natural History. Well, Hugh Raffles, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
You won much acclaim for your last book, Insectopedia. In fact, I was at the award ceremony where you accepted the Orion Award for that book. What moved you to go from insects to rocks?
You know, part of it was that I think I was so caught in this idea of writing a book that was focused on a kind of object or a thing that I immediately, when I was thinking about the next book, I just went from one sort of category of thing to another category of thing. And so went from insects to rocks. And it was rocks because for the insect book, I did some fieldwork in China and on fighting crickets. And it was people who trained crickets to fight. And I love that field work. It was, you know, the people were amazing. They had these incredible relationships with these tiny little insects. They really knew how to communicate with them. But while I was doing the field work, I started to meet people who collected these stones called, which, you know, I think here people know as scholars' rocks. Sometimes they're like stones that people keep on their desks, or you'd also see them in parks or gardens or that sort of thing. So very different sizes. And many of the people who I talked about them in these very sort of very sophisticated ways as these like contemplative objects. And that really got me thinking about stones in ways that I hadn't done before and got me interested in really thinking about what it would be like to write a book about them. Because there was just so much more complicated, I think. And this wasn't even the geology part of it. These were just sort of as objects which just people develop relationships with and created all kinds of, you know, ways of thinking and emotion. And so I just started to get very interested and the book really, I think, developed from there.
Yes, and it's an opportunity for you to explore all kinds of things aside from geology. You explore, as you say, people's emotions about rocks, the whole history of exploitation in certain areas, you know, the cultural aspects of them, your own personal history. I was interested, you quote Mircea Eliade, who wrote about myths, who also was a kind of fascist, but and he also had some really, you know, really wonderful writings talking about culture. He said, stone is. Why do you quote him? What's your sense of what that means?
Oh, what a great question. Yeah, I have a very complicated relationship with Eliade, as you could tell from the book, I'm sure, because he was a fascist. I mean, an active fascist and an anti-Semite in Romania before the Second World War. You know, he was somebody who, he was one of those sort of middle European encyclopedic intellectuals who just had this enormous command of material and collected, you know, he just like collected data from every possible source. And he then, after the war, he moved to Chicago and to the University of Chicago. They gave him a job, you know, in the way that many fascist refugees after the war ended up in the United States as well as in other countries. And he was regarded as being, he sort of managed to sort of rewrite his history and was regarded as the leading authority on religion in this very sort of like encyclopedic mode. And he was very, very interested in thinking about, he wrote a lot about stone and stone monuments and stone objects, and he would write about them. He would look for parallels across the world and across cultures of the same kinds of religious practices. And the ones that interested me were the ones that related to stone objects, particularly, you know, like the worship of stone objects of different kinds. And he was very interested, and I think what he meant by that quote was in the presence of stone, the materiality of it, you know, the sort of fact of it. And that also interested me a lot, not just trying to think about, you know, the meanings that people give to the object and the substance, but that the object itself has this presence and it makes, or the substance has this presence and makes certain ways of thinking possible or certain kinds of actions possible depending on the context. And he sort of slipped a little bit between that and also saying that stone only had meaning and sort of reality because of the reality that people brought to it. And I was more interested in thinking about the, you know, the sort of the weight and power of the object and the substance itself. But his work is extremely thought-provoking because it's so wide-ranging and because it's so, I suppose, so philosophical in a way. You know, he's so thoughtful about these kinds of questions. So, yeah, it's very provocative, though, right, to say, like, stone is, you know, it feels like it's just like the beginning of a sentence, you know, that you need to fill in the rest. So, yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking about that and wondering about it in the different contexts that I write about.
Now, the title is A Book of Unconformities. Maybe you should start by telling our listeners, what is an unconformity?
An unconformity is, you know, it's a geological term for a gap in the, it's a gap in the geological record. It's the point at which two layers of rock from different and non-sequential time periods meet. So there might be, so these two layers will meet, but there could be a huge gap in time between them. So you can think of it, you know, sort of metaphorically as a hole in time. And, you know, it begs the question of what is in there in that gap? You know, what is it that's missing that can't be filled in? So I started to think of it in this way as a, you know, like a metaphor for geology, for all of geology, archaeology, history, and memory, because it points for me anyway to the limits of evidence. It points up to what you don't know. And also because of that gap generates all this speculation and imagination. You know, it's like it forces us to fill in that gap. And so there are all these moments in history, and in modern history, say something like the Holocaust or the Middle Passage, where, you know, we know these things happen, but they're also like these holes that we don't really know how to fill in because of the immensity of the events. It's just like this gap. And so we fill in those gaps with all these stories and narratives. It's like the, you know, the absence sort of really pulls us into creating more and more accounts to fill them.
Speculations on lost time, as you say.
Exactly. That sort of became what the book was about. And as you say, I was, you know, I was preoccupied by these own events in my own life, where two of my sisters died within a few weeks of each other, really. Now it's 25 years ago. But you know, just sort of like this absence. And that really started me thinking about the relationship between these personal events and the sort of the ripples they have, or the aftermath, the sort of really long lasting aftermath of those kind of events. And then the ways that these very large scale historical events are also filled with all these personal stories that, you know, that we think of them as these sort of like statistical abstractions, but they're also filled with, you know, all of them are just, that's made up of all these personal stories and small scale stories, all of which have these, you know, deep personal effects on people.
And these links to eons. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Hugh Raffles, author of the acclaimed book Insectopedia, about his new book, The Book of Unconformities. It's part natural history, part memoir, part meditation on the relationships between people and rocks throughout time. In the first chapter, Marble, you take us to the Manhattan neighborhood of Inwood, and you take us up to a park that was probably the major site for the Lenape Indians, a pre-conquest. I've been there. It's a wonderful place. It has deep history, both geological and, you know, human history. Tell us about the Lenape. Tell us about Inwood and why you chose to go there and what the connection is to Marble.
So that chapter was really, it started as a chapter about the veins of marble which run through Manhattan. Marble is one of the three bedrock materials of Manhattan. And it sort of comes to the surface in a few places, but really sort of most prominently in that part of the city uptown. And that chapter started because a friend of mine, actually two friends of mine, suggested that I join them on a long walk the length of Broadway. But although we weren't really sure, we knew where Broadway started in Lower Manhattan, but we didn't really know where it was going to end. But they sort of figured it out and decided it was going to end in Sleepy Hollow, you know, in just sort of north of the Bronx. And so we took a train up there and walked down. And, you know, I was really unprepared for it. They were very organized and had the right shoes and the right socks and stuff like that. And I was very unorganized and had, you know, a lot of blisters by the end of it and all that kind of stuff. But we walked down and then through the Bronx, and we got to Marble Hill and Inwood. And for me, that was when the walk started to get really interesting. I didn't know that part of the city at all. I knew Manhattan, pretty much all of Manhattan, pretty well, because I've lived here for a long time. But I didn't really know that piece of it. And, you know, because that actually, you know, at the moment it isn't in Manhattan. It's in the Bronx. But because I was interested and I started looking into the history once the walk was done, and discovered this story about how Marble Hill had been part of Manhattan, and then this canal, the Harlem Ship Canal, was cut. Basically, it was sort of moved. The creek that separated Marble Hill is attached to Manhattan, separated from the Bronx by Spite and Devil Creek, but the Army Corps of Engineers moved it to create better shipping access to the Hudson and then the Erie Canal. So they created the Harlem Ship Canal south of Marble Hill, and then sort of reattached Marble Hill. It was an island for a little while, and then they reattached it to the Bronx by using some of the fill that they'd taken out of the ship canal. So, you know, this is very interesting to think about. But in doing that, I started coming across all this information about the Lenape, because the route to Marble Hill, that people knew Marble Hill before Europeans came, as they knew it as the shimmering, it was called the something like something that translates as sort of like the shimmering place because of all the marble there. And it was tied into Lower Manhattan, where the colonists first settled, by these pathways and routes which run the length of the island. And I became very, very, very interested in just this, you know, this really almost total erasure of native history in New York City. Just the invisibility of the Lenape. Things have changed a little bit in the last few years, but it's really astonishing how important that history was and how absent it is. So for quite a long time, I became very, the chapter sort of changed. My interest in the chapter changed as you said, it really became about this history. You know, to me, this became another of these absences that I was interested in the book. But I tried to track it through the history of this marble and people's relationships to these parts of the city that were Lenape relationships to these parts of the city that were where the marble was more evident. And the clearest place of that really was up in Inwood and in Inwood Hill Park, where you have these rock shelters that were occupied, maybe seasonally occupied for thousands of years, and are now actually seasonally occupied by homeless people in the city. So, you know, you've got these sort of like histories of, I mean, one way to think of it is like these histories of displacement, which continue. So in a way, it was sort of like that chapter became a history of Manhattan through these different moments of occupation and displacement. And one of the ones which this maybe seems unrelated, but somehow to me, you know, like writing the story, it wasn't one of them that was important to me also, was the history of AIDS in the city and the sort of massive changes that came about through, you know, really the loss of so many people to AIDS in the 1980s and early to mid 90s, which is when I came to New York in the late 80s. And part of that was just through the huge, there's like really, really substantial real estate changes that happened because so many people died and moved out of, you know, all these apartments were vacated, but also because of the loss of such a, you know, these people who are so active in the community and in arts of various kinds. So, you know, there's this very significant transformation of New York that happened in that period. And that also seemed like another moment of really significant transformation.
Yes, and another displacement. I know that my mother was a member of the Soho artist Renaissance. She was a dancer and choreographer, and she had a company, and all her male dancers died of AIDS, each one of them, and they were wonderful dancers. What a loss. And you lost a friend there also, Vince.
Yeah, I lost, you know, many people I knew died at that time, but I wrote a little bit about Vince in the chapter, at the end of that chapter, as a way to, partly because I wanted to try to make these connections and to try to think about, you know, try to think about what a, I don't know how to say this, but maybe something like what an important home Manhattan was for so many people. So many different kinds of people over so long, despite all the complications of it, and how, yeah, it was very hard. It's very hard to think about it. So the chapter is quite impressionistic in that way, I think. But that chapter took me a very long time. You know, like I said, it started with that walk, so it has that feeling of moving through time and space.
Well, you know, that puts me, Mike. I have a little comment here. You know, you're writing reminds me of a flaneur in a way, a literary flaneur. You talk about a walk. I mean, Walter Benjamin, you know, Benjamin wrote about Paris and the flaneur. You know, his work is very discursive, as is yours. It also reminds me of W.G. Zabold. I just wondered if you've read Zabold, because it was striking, you know, including the use of photographs and the touching on so many different points of contact to your subject.
Yeah, I think Zabold is very important to me. I have read his work, you know, closely, I think, because it really meant a lot to me and has done when I first read it particularly. And one of the aspects of it that I think that I was thinking a lot about when I was writing this book is the way he has this ability to, you start off a sentence or paragraph in one place, and then without even realizing it, he's somehow collapsed time and you've arrived somewhere else entirely. It could be like on another place entirely, another time. It could be there could be a different narrator from there was at the beginning of the sentence even. So he has these techniques or strategies for making you inhabit this space and not even really know where you are, so that you get you have this experience of the way that he sees time operating, so that time becomes really, really fluid and you know, the linearity of time can collapse or disappear. Yeah, I think that's sort of an amazing thing to be able to do.
I so agree, and just like unconformities.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was really trying to figure out in this book how to do that and how to, you know, like create a space where people have that experience. And I think my solutions to it were quite different from his in some ways. And I don't know that it's always successful, and it's certainly not always successful for everybody. But, you know, that's why there's some of those sentences are so long, because I'm really trying to figure out how to convey all that. I want people to have that experience, you know, sort of disorientation. So I like to think that, you know, people are reading those sentences and they sort of get lost in them, and they might have to go back. They might have to, you know, try to figure out where they are. So it's not a sort of smooth experience. And so they also experience the disruptions of linearity in that way.
Well, I enjoyed that. I think it was very successful. And Zabold is one of my very favorite writers. So,
yeah, that's mine too. Mine too. And I like Benjamin as well a lot.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Hugh Raffles about his new book, The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. So you talked about Manhattan, and, you know, one of the things you say there, which is so interesting because I've never seen anyone else say this, but I've thought about it for decades, that Manhattan has so much energy because of the crystalline structure of its schist. Is that how you pronounce it?
Schist, yeah.
And yet you say that's something people actually do remark on. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, when I first came to, you know, I came from London, and when I first came, I was so just, I mean, like many people, you know, just, I don't know, like excited isn't really the word for it, but just like, you know, sort of transformed by Manhattan in those, at that time. Everything about it was just sort of amazing to me. And liberating, I think, as well. And, you know, and I would walk all over the city, and, you know, just constantly, like, you know, just be having experiences all the time, you know, like meeting and talking to people and seeing things and just, you know, just being completely wide-eyed all the time and feel so energized. And I would just talk to people about that all the time, about, you know, what is all this energy and why is everything happening at this speed and never seeming to stop and all this. And people would say to me, it's because of the stone. People would say it's because Manhattan is built on granite. It's just like this big slab of granite, and we all get this energy from it. So we just like can't stop. It's out of our control. This is the way we are. I'm not really sure that's true. And anyway, you know, it's not granite. It's actually, most of it is schist. But I really like that idea of feeling, you know, despite all this movement, everything is so grounded. And I think that's sort of true as well. Even when you get the train into Manhattan from another borough and you arrive, there's, even today when it's changed so much and the demographics of the city have changed so much, there's still this intensity about it and density about it. And you have this feeling that, you know, that random things can just happen, even just like taking the subway, even at the moment where, you know, the way things are. Even just taking the subway, things can happen. I don't mean sort of like random violence or that sort of thing, which was a lot of what was on people's mind in the late 80s, but just encounters that are just so stimulating and so mind-opening and make you think about things in a different way. And I'd never had that experience anywhere else, certainly not in London, even though it's a big, dense city. And I like that people had this, you know, had this very concrete way of explaining it. You know, that it was like, oh, this is why it's like that. Just, you know, okay, maybe that's the case. Maybe that's why. But I like that idea. It's always stuck with me. You know, we arrive there and we're just, somehow there's this other force which is forcing us to be this way in ways that we haven't really been before.
Hugh Raffles. Stay tuned for more of our conversation with him about the Book of Unconformities after the break.
A song, a blessing on this place.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Let's get back to my conversation with Hugh Raffles about the Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. It's part natural history, part memoir, part meditation on the relationships between people and rocks throughout time. So the next chapter is sandstone. And you go to a place that I've also been to and enchanted by, the Isle of Lewis. And you talk about the standing stones there. I mean, I found this absolutely fascinating. Well, your whole book is, but this was also of special interest to me because they're so mysterious, these stones. Talk about the stones of the Isle of Lewis and, you know, what the meaning of them was to you.
Yeah. So this relates directly back to what I was saying earlier about my sisters. One of my sisters, Sister Frankie, used to live right next to the stones at Callanish. And I used to visit her when I was a teenager, and so got to know the stones a little then. I would go up there. She, by the way, had no interest in them at all. But they were just behind the house she lived in, so I would go up the hill and spend time up there just looking at them and trying and sort of touching them and trying to understand them. They were within, you know, the Neolithic world, they're a very, very famous. They're one of the major stone circles in the United Kingdom. And they were probably a very, very important center for probably, you know, commercial center, ritual center, just a center for travelers in this Neolithic world, which spanned the east coast of Ireland, the north of Scotland, probably Brittany, maybe the southwest of England. There was just this sort of a maritime world that existed then, it seems, you know, from archaeologists.
And when? Give us a time period.
Well, this is probably 4,000 years ago, I think, maybe. Yes, about 4,000 years ago, 4,500 years ago. And Callanish was the stones at Callanish, they're very striking. They're on top of a ridge, so they dominate the surrounding area. And they're not so much, there is a small circle in them, but they're actually in a cross shape. There's like a long extending avenue and then two avenues that extend out from this small circle. And the stones themselves are actually very beautiful. They're nice and hornblende. Hornblende is black and shiny. And the gneiss is extremely old, some of the oldest stone that you have in probably on the planet, actually. It could be 3 billion years old. And it's very banded, sort of almost psychedelic looking with pinks and grays. But the stones are, you know, like all these standing stones, and all these Neolithic stones, they're really completely enigmatic. You know, you can imagine this is a center of some kind. But beyond that, at this point, you don't really know how people related to them, what they meant for them, what happened there. Everything is really speculation. So there are a lot of people who think that they have some astronomical purpose. They seem to line up with a cleft in some nearby hills or hills on the horizon. And at certain days and certain times, the sun will shine in a particular direction. But the problem with that kind of reasoning really is that, you know, people are looking for those relationships. So they start with the assumption that there's going to be something like that. And then they find it because you always can find some kind of relationship if you look hard enough. So you can never be sure that that's, except in some cases, in certain places where it's really undeniable because the sun will just like flood this cavity on a particular day, which you know has some significance. So, you know, there are places where that happens for sure. But in Callanish, the effect of the sun is, and actually mostly the moon in Callanish, is quite subtle. So it's uncertain that that's the reason. So I get very interested in that. You know, in that explanation, and just that as a form of storytelling to explain this mystery, really.
Filling in the gaps, as you said before.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it really seemed like that. Yeah, this sort of enigmatic quality of these rocks is very fascinating to me. And so that, in that case, it became, you know, this opportunity to then think about, because my sister there, to think more personally about that gap and how and how that gap gets filled, you know, the absence of somebody who dies who's close to you.
And you spoke about NICE, which is spelled G-N-E-I-S-S, and I thought to myself, NICE is nice, but not so nice when it's the location of a brutal enclosure movement in the mid-19th century. Talk about Callanish or Callanay, a man named Matheson, and the enclosure movement.
Yes, so... You know, so you have these stones, and these stones are very enigmatic. And when you're starting to try, or for me, anyway, when I'm starting to try to understand them, I start to think historically about them, try to find out as much as I can. And the entire Isle of Lewis was purchased in the 1840s by a colonial businessman called James Matheson, who had been one of the founders of a trading company called Jardine Matheson, which became the largest British trading company involved in the opium trade in China. So effectively, the money that he used to buy Lewis, the Isle of Lewis, was money from the drug trade. And there's actually his wife, he then had an estate in Lewis, and his wife built a monument to him, which is decorated with... It's a marble monument decorated with poppies all the way around it, as sort of reference to the source of his fortune.
Wow.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing. And he, when he bought the island, you know, this was at a moment when there was a lot of Victorian rediscovery of these monuments as a way to celebrate British history. It became sort of part of the nationalist project of recovering an ancient British history and, you know, the sort of the greatness of British history. So Scotland, particularly the Highlands and Islands, were a location for the sort of the new rich, the sort of industrial rich, wealthy, they would travel there to get some experience of wild nature and actually wild people as well. And when Matheson took over Lewis, he restored the stones. He dug up, there was like 5 feet of peat that he took off because they were barely visible at the time he took them over. And he sort of restored them as this, as a visit, as a site for his, you know, his friends and family to visit. As you know, they were very sort of like Victorian romantic, and you know, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert also had, you know, they had their whole Scottish life as well. You know, the castle at Balmoral, and you know, which is featured in The Crown, in the series of The Crown. You know, they would go to Balmoral, and they would. They have this whole Scottish lifestyle with kilts and stag hunting and grouse hunting. And they invented a lot of that stuff at that time, actually. The whole like romantic Scotland thing. And so the stones at Callanish formed part of that. They became part of that whole, you know, celebration of the sort of like romantic wild side of Britain. And in a way, the sort of taming of that as well by the British upper classes and the new industrial upper class that was replacing, which had made their money really in colonialism and British colonialism, but was replacing the aristocracy and also the clans who had been really running Scotland up until the early 19th century. And the enclosure movement was part of that.
Yeah, so I mean, he actually forced the people who were there, those wild people that, you know, he might have gone to be interested in, he forced them off the land. They in fact, they faced a choice between eviction and a ticket out to North America.
Exactly. And thousands of people ended up in Canada and the United States at that time in a very short period. I don't remember the exact years, but it was a very short period of time. And that was partly driven by a famine, which was, you know, happening at the same time as the Irish famine, or just a little bit later. But from a very similar, you know, it was also a potato famine, but hasn't been recorded at the same, you know, isn't as well known as that. So people were just forced. They had this double pressure, the pressure of famine and the pressure of enclosures, where they were losing their own land, and it was being taken over and created into these large, what the landowners wanted to do really was farm sheep on them. They didn't want people to farm on them, and they were also and grow their own crops. So that also, you know, contributed to the to starvation. And then when people couldn't pay their basically couldn't pay their rent on the lands, then they were offered the option of going across the Atlantic. And so you got this large-scale depopulation of the islands in that time. And that also, you know, contributed to their sort of romantic quality, because then they became emptier and bleaker and more, you know, more about the landscape and less about the people.
Yes, and another displacement that you go into, there's a couple of chapters that are just amazing about iron. First, I'd like to talk about the geological aspect of it, but you also use these chapters to talk about the displacements of the Inuit and the other indigenous peoples of the Arctic Circle. So first of all, tell us about the connection between a meteor that hit Greenland and the abrupt climate change event at the end of the Pleistocene epoch.
Yeah, this is very interesting. This is recent. This is very recent research. I mean, over the last, year, I suppose, couple of years. I came into it sort of backwards. I first got interested in these meteorites that were taken from Greenland in the 1890s by Robert Peary, who was at the time a very, very famous American explorer of the Arctic, who was working and collecting for the Museum of Natural History in New York, but also really for himself, and very much wanted to be the first, as he put it, the first white man to go to the North Pole.
And he went there with a black man, which is another great story.
Exactly. with Matthew Henson. Yeah, that's quite a story. And Peary was always trying to just, he was always hustling, you know, always hustling to get more money and to get more from his backers and all this kind of stuff. He was a very entrepreneurial person, very, very interested in his own career. So he needed, you know, these trips to the Arctic were very, very expensive. He would travel, he needed a ship, he needed all these people to go with him, all this kind of thing. It took a lot, all these supplies. So he needed to show, you know, when he went, he also always needed to come back. He had to come back with something. He always needed to have needs to be something that he could demonstrate made the trip worthwhile. So he'd heard about these meteorites because they'd been recorded by earlier European travelers, British travelers, to this area in Northwest Greenland about 50 years earlier. And he knew that was an option, really, and he was getting very, very short of money, and so he decided he was going to bring those back. So he found these, and this is a very long way around to answer your question, I'm sorry about climate change, but he brought these back. And the part of the story that was particularly fascinating to me was that when he brought the meteorites back, and it was two separate trips, but when he brought on the second trip, when he brought them back, he also came back with six people from this region, six Inuit people from the region, from these communities.
Say their names again. Six what people?
Inuit. So they're related to Inuit people, but they were the people in Northwest who lived in Northwest Greenland. I suppose there's not many people, probably at that time it was a couple of hundred, maybe 270, something like that, because Peary did a census of the population in this area, who lived in two or three communities. And he would work with these people. They worked for him as assistants and as, you know, as seamstresses, you know, making all his clothes for the expedition, as hunters. They basically were the infrastructure for his expeditions and had been since he'd been going there about, I think, 10 or 12 years earlier, and he would go regularly. So he knew a lot of these people and their families very well, and he would enroll them in his projects. And he made them extremely dependent on him, because he would supply them with all these goods that they had no way of getting otherwise, you know, processed foods, rifles, you know, clothes, textiles, all these things, pots and pans, things which people had no way of getting otherwise. Although people did have all kinds of trade networks, he tried to make out that people were completely separated from the world, but that really wasn't true. People had been involved with, like, cross-Arctic trading networks for actually hundreds of years, which also went into right north into Asia and, you know, were really over long distances. And they traded metal from these meteorites as well for a very long time. But he got them to work with him. He got them to show him where the meteorites were. And he found the meteorites, brought them back to New York, to the Museum of Natural History. And he also brought back these six people. And this is a very tragic story. Four of those people died within a few weeks of being back. One of them didn't die. One of them went back to Greenland, but had a very complicated life when he was back there and didn't live very long. And the last one, who was a child who came with him, lived for a few years. In the end, died in Pennsylvania, I think, virtually homeless, and became sort of a celebrity in the U.S. Got written up, gave interviews in the papers denouncing Peary and the museum. You know, it's a very complicated story that I tell in quite a lot of detail in the book. I think it's very fascinating, actually.
Yes, it is, because a theme in your book, you know, not just discontinuities and filling in, uncovering the mysteries of the gaps, but also histories of exploitation of, you know, indigenous people, of black people. I mean, as we said, we didn't really talk about Matthew Henson, who co-discovered the North Pole with Robert Peary, and who was, after that, became persona non grata to Peary, probably because Peary didn't want to share the glory, you know, but also so much dislocation and tragedy that runs through this, you know, that we've become so clear about in these days, clearer than ever, at least it's being talked about. So tell us about what are the human lessons that you derived from this. There's culture and there's also, you know, basic humanity. How did you weave those two things together?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. So I think there's a few things. One of them is that in a way this book became, you know, emerged out of this very particular period in American history and in world history. You know, I wrote it and rewrote it over the last 4 years during the Trump period. And when, you know, there's been all this attention to, you know, the world has seemed very, very dark. It's not just the Trump period. It's also what's been happening, you know, with you know, refugees and migration and displacement and now the pandemic and just increasing, you know, just like rampant inequality in the world on a global scale as well. So I think a lot of the way I was telling the stories and thinking about the world was in some ways a product of that. It was more melancholy, I think, than it might have been if I'd written it in a different period. Although now, I don't know if that will change now, because I think we're always going to live with a sense of fragility that maybe we didn't have before. But so some of it is definitely colored with that. But also I think it's because really, you know, Francesca, this is a really great question. I'm not sure how to answer it. I was very struck writing the book how it kept turning to that. And that, you know, how it kept turning to these questions, these sort of moments of trauma and of, you know, personal loss. And also, like, as you say, exploitation. The chapter on Svalbard is about these waves of exploitation of different, you know, first of different animals and then of people and of the land. And it's just like one, just sort of extraction, sort of very brutal extraction, just one after the other, after the other. And that is very much the frame of the book, I think. I think that's right.
And I think it's an important one. Now, I mean, this is a book of incredible beauty, contemplation, very thought-provoking. And that theme emerges not in a way to, like, hit you over the head with it, but in a way of so clearly making the connection between this beautiful earth that we have inherited, that we have been bequeathed. And to me, I really took this as, you know, let's think about what are we doing here? Let's appreciate more and extract less.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very much the sort of foundation of the book. I think in some ways I want to take that for granted as something that people would take from the book. And I think also I want them to have a sense of possibility as well. Like, you know, well, yeah, this is the way that things have ended up in some of these stories. They've had these tragic unfoldings. But, you know, if we can kind of like put ourselves inside these moments as much as possible and think of what was happening there, you know, part of the reason for revisiting the past is to think of how we can, I mean, in some ways to repair it, that we can recognize that this happened to people, because a lot of these are stories that, you know, we might not really know had actually happened. I didn't know many of these stories before I started doing the research on them. And so, you know, we should understand that this is what happened to people, and this is the sort of inheritance and what people live with. You know, this is in this part of Greenland, these stories of the loss of these six people who came to New York, this is really important to how people live now. And this is also part of what you see when you go to the Museum of Natural History and see these meteorites. This is part of the story of the meteorites. And you need to know that. You can't just be innocent when you see them. You have to understand that that's what you're witnessing, and you get to witness it because this is what happened. And by being there, you're also complicit in this to some extent, in the pleasures that you get from seeing them. And it's important to understand this context and understand, I think, our own location in relation to that. So part of the reason for knowing that is so that we understand that. But in understanding that, maybe we can be more, you know, more aware and more active in moving forward and thinking about, well, for instance, you know, like, what should museums be? What does the city look like if we think about it as being made by Native Americans and Native American history? And how do we make that evident and understand that we've inherited that too? If we're not Native American, then that's also part of who we are as people who live here. So I think part of the purpose of the book is to, you know, open that space for people to, you know, see all these different forces and histories at work and try to think how they want to orient themselves to that, and how they can live in that, how they might live knowing all that, you know, and knowing that that's part of the life that we've all inherited. You know, I have this line in there early, which something about, you know, we move through the world as if we're tourists. And when I was writing the chapter in New York, I really thought about that, how, you know, we sort of move through wherever we are as if we're separate from it, as if we're not like part of the histories that made it, or implicit in it, or complicit in it, in everything that went into making the present, as if we're just living in the present and witnessing the present. But we're really not. We're also outcomes of everything that got us to this moment, you know, whether it's in our personal histories or not. And that doesn't mean that we're, you know, like guilty in some way or responsible, as in, you know, like we carry the burden of making it better. But it does mean that we need to be, I think it means we need to be aware of that and understand who we are historically. In a way, this is the claim of, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter and racial reckoning of the summer. I mean, I think that's part of what that call was for. It was to, you know, like recognize who we all are and how we've got to this point.
Right. It's like, you know, Black Lives Matter points to a gap, just like the gap of the unconformity. I mean, there's that gap where people don't see that. Yeah, of course, all lives matter. That's precisely why Black Lives Matter.
Exactly. And there are specific histories that have gone into making things the way they are. It's really important to understand those if we want to understand the world we live in.
Yes. Well, this has just been a delight to talk with you, Hugh Raffles. Your book is The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. It was a delight to read as well. Thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. I've really, really enjoyed talking to you.
Hugh Raffles. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Book of Unconformities. Next up, a story. Some of my listeners know that I've been writing a book. Province of the Heart is about 8 months I spent in a small village in Provence, where I went to live just days after 9/11, the terror attacks in the U.S. Part travel memoir, part journey of healing, Province of the Heart is about the true values that we must take to heart to survive and thrive in our troubled world. These are values I learned as I became a part of the village and its life. I tell the story through observations of nature and place, people and culture, and I give my thoughts on the challenges we face and how we can surmount them. I'm happy to say the book is done and it's in the hands of a book Sherpa. We have a few minutes left, so here's a passage from the book that takes place a week after my arrival in Provence. I found a measure of restoration in this remote and beautiful region where the connections between people and between people and place are always vivid and palpable. No one embodied the spirit of connection more than one Monsieur Quévan, the cure hunter. A week after my arrival, I traveled to Fauquelcer, a small city that holds a market on Mondays where a cornucopia of delights is on display. I was looking for an herbal tea to cure my troubled sleep. During the day, the charms of my new surroundings distracted me, but at night, I wrestled with horror about what I had left behind in America and anxiety about the future. I tossed and turned on my narrow bed, rocked by a stormy sea of dread. Provence is a botanical garden of medicinal herbs, of which lavender is the best known. Strolling among the market booths, I chanced upon the perfect thing, a table laid out with an array of cellophane packages of dried herbs neatly stacked in rows. Monsieur Catusian Quévan, ramasseur des simples, said the sign on the vendor's van. I browsed silently, searching for something familiar among the offerings. But the French names confused me, and I hovered in indecision. A short, stocky man with a rumpled look moved around the interior of the van. Then he peered out at me with an air of friendly invitation. "Is there something I can help you with?" he asked. I told him my problem, and he pointed to a bag filled with elongated leaves and wisps of small flowers. "Many people use tilleul to help them sleep," he offered as he handed it to me. Tilleul is the linden tree. The steeped leaves create a tea with a floral, slightly sweet taste. "Are they grown bio?" I asked, using the European term for organic. "Ah," he exclaimed with delight, as if this were the very question he'd been waiting for. "See?" And he pointed to his sign, "Ramasseur des simples." That means I gather all the herbs from the wild, and I am the only one in the whole region to do so, he proclaimed. All the other herbs sold here are grown by farmers, often with chemicals. He wrinkled his nose in disapproval. "Where do your herbs come from?" "All over. Take this one, for example. Do you know what it is?" "L'ail des ours," the label showed. "Bear's garlic," I translated silently. I shook my head no. "I take that from the Massif Central, the great plateau to the north of here. Sometimes I travel hundreds of kilometers to find a single bush, and I can spend days in the hunt." "It must cost a lot in fuel and labor if you're traveling so far. How do you make any money?" I asked him. A slow smile lit his grizzled face. "I don't make much, but I don't need much either. What do I need a lot of money for? I have a home, enough food to eat. If I charged according to the labor, nobody would buy my herbs." His prices were indeed reasonable, less than $3 for a good-sized bag. And there was the pleasure of spending one's days hiking the hills and valleys of Wild Provence. Your work must be enjoyable too, no? Voila, he agreed, then confided. I am a chasseur, really. Others hunt animals, I hunt plants. It's a kind of sport for me. It's le chasse du curé, cure hunting. Are the plants all that difficult to find? Don't you know where to find them from one year to the next? Not at all. One year, the plant is here. Another year, it's somewhere else. Some years, there are many. Others, none at all. Nature is like that. And he grinned broadly, undisturbed by the vagaries of supply. Monsieur Catuzian is a happy man. He loves his work. His needs are few. The sun-drenched hills of southern France are his workshop and study. That evening I steeped some dried leaves of tilleul and imbibed the steaming tisane. Then I slept like a baby. That was a passage edited for radio from my book, Province of the Heart. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.